music from Don Moen and a song called Hiding Place. 11 minutes after the hour, Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times, joins us. David is here, and Doug is in Columbia, Maryland, just right off the edge of Washington, D.C. What's the buzz around your city now after Iowa? Do people over there pay any attention to Iowa?
Of course they do. Yeah. And there are lots of buzzes. I guess you have to talk about which elevation of buzz that you're thinking on. But this past Sunday, I heard about a special presentation that was going on at a big church inside of Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. sort of an adult education contemporary forum kind of thing. And because Pete Wehner was going to be speaking on being a Christian in an ever increasingly adversarial environment. And he's a colleague of Michael Gerson. Together they wrote a book. He was on three staffs of three White Houses. He was a primary speechwriter for George Bush, et cetera, et cetera. And just a very articulate, perceptive guy. And he said something I thought was really interesting. He's telling about a Jewish atheistic acquaintance of his, who I think was in the journalistic field, who wanted to get a better feel for what in the world this evangelical Christian thing was all about. Because of the phrase evangelical Christian that keeps getting tossed around in the media.
Yeah.
And so he contacted Pete and said, give me the name of some churches I can go to try to get a feel as to what this evangelical Christian thing was all about. And Pete said, well, I can give you the name of some churches, but what I'd rather have you do is let me give you some names of places what churches are involved in. So he gave him a name of a pregnancy clinic and a homeless shelter operation and an operation that cared for orphans. And you get the idea. And so this Jewish atheistic journalist began to go visit those places and came back eventually to Pete over time and said, I had no idea how merciful and compassionate and kind these evangelical Christians are and how they're out there serving. And what the point he was saying is, my only framework for an evangelical Christian is what I hear on the media.
Mm-hmm. Their political segment.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but here's another observation. How in the world does it come to be that evangelical Christians can be kind and compassionate and merciful as they minister in the world, in the community, and a goodly number of them, once they get in front of a camera, start to become shrill and strident and anything but gracious and merciful.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that a fascinating observation, the so-called dichotomy between the actual reality of evangelical Christianity in the world and the way it either comes across or is portrayed on the media, which then gave me, I started to think about that. And I wondered if we needed a new term, particularly as the phrase evangelical Christian was tossed around in Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
Of who they're supposed to like and who they're not supposed to like, et cetera, et cetera. We got this word rhino.
Yep.
Republicans in name only.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I thought, we need another phrase, a vino. Evangelicals in name only.
Yeah. Well, there is that, but I'd like to get away from the term evangelical at all, because as you've taught us here, but there's evangelicalism and there's discipleship, and we divided them, and it's one concept historically, and we just misunderstand that in the West. I really like the term Christ follower. I think it's more inclusive and less political. And it says what you're about, what you do. And I also think it's interesting in your story that he wouldn't have seen that example of compassion and care and love by going to a church to begin with. That it would have been a different story entirely in his mind, most likely.
Oh, maybe I didn't tell the story well. He did visit some churches as well and interact with the people. And, the response that I portrayed here was an integrated response.
Gotcha. Okay.
No, it wasn't that the churches were anti grace and compassion as well. It's just that it just struck me, if only 10% of the United States or less are in the circle of evangelicalism, however you care to define that, then 90% of the people in America are getting their understanding of evangelicalism through the media, and that's a scary thought.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And the other part of it, too, is particularly in politics, that the mainstream media has categorized evangelical Christians as a political group, period. And that can mean that some guy got a survey form at one time, and on the back of it, it said, "Do you consider yourself an evangelical Christian?" And the guy said, "Well, let's see, I went to church last year, and it's okay. I guess I'm an evangelical Christian." It's less descriptive than it is, categorizing a group of people who also like the Second Amendment, also like to don't care for homosexual marriage all that much. It's a very big, broad category.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is, and the danger is, and increasingly young people are turned off by the church because I think they're doing exactly what you're saying. The perception mm-hmm. is the church has become a political party.
Well, the language becomes right. debased, too. Conservative means nasty, angry, and liberal means progressive, and that's a nice-sounding word, you know?
Yeah. As far as the mainstream media is concerned,
yeah,
sure.
And the media is a big part of it. But the debasing of the language has a lot to do with how people come to understand things from generation mm-hmm. to generation, and a lot of words don't mean the same thing they did 30, 40 years ago or 100.
Well, the
years
other
ago.
Thing, another observation Pete made, he says he just finds it humorous that this phrase "constitutional conservative" gets thrown around, mm-hmm. which means. As the translation of which is, we don't compromise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he says, the irony of that is, if you've gone into the context, the history, the background of how the U.S. Constitution was created, it's littered with compromise.
It's all compromise. Yeah.
Between the North and the South, between mm-hmm. the big states and the small states. Mm-hmm. And so if you're a constitutionalist, you have to be for compromise because that's the whole foundation of the document you're citing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the big compromise was counting blacks as three-fifths of a person. And all the decisions that were compromised, there was even rules at one time that you were not allowed to say or talk about slavery in Congress. Mm-hmm. And you were, I'm not sure what the punishment was, but there were all kinds of rules that those are the things, the subjects you were not to be brought up at all. Mm-hmm. And that was a compromise with the South, with Southern leadership. Yeah, well, very shifting, interesting.
Shifting subjects here, I mean, it was Groundhog's Day yesterday. Are there any groundhogs in East Dakota?
No, we have no vermin here. No rodents. No rodents allowed.
Well, I thought it was the state animal.
No, we only have not just outside the border in Minnesota. They have lots of them.
Oh, they got lots of them. They're hip deep in groundhogs.
Here's the thing. The conundrum I just couldn't solve. If there are groundhogs in East Dakota, and I know that the sun never shines in East Dakota, I mean, how do you ever get spring?
Well, that's the problem. We don't.
Or it's always spring.
Yeah, we can look at it. Look at the bright side. Yeah. This is spring. Yeah.
Guys, you remember what we're doing? Remember last week?
Yeah, I do. And we missed you for a couple of weeks, and we wanted to catch up with you, where you've been, and you talked about Kansas. And we started getting into friendships and relationships between guys. We were talking about the paralytic who went through the roof, as I recall. And I suggest we go there again today because there's lots more to be said about that. And I know that's in two different books in the Bible. It's in Mark chapter 2 and it's in Luke 5. And each slightly varying accounts. But this is an interesting story to me because it must have been early in Jesus' ministry, wasn't it?
Well, it was. And I've just been struck here by the play on words of your opener, the paralytic who went through the roof.
I was funning with you. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean that plays two ways. Yeah. Anyway, here's the issue from 30,000 feet. We read these narratives in Scripture, these encounters that Jesus has with people, And there's a number of ways we can read them. One, we can read them from 100 yards away, as if this is far removed, far distant. Interesting, maybe. But we read it in such a way that we don't personally identify with the passage at all. And so I think that's part of the role of context, is to repaint the picture, to take it from one dimension into three dimension, so that we can start to relate to the story, and here's the more important thing, place ourselves into the narrative, to identify with one or more of the actual participants in the story. When that happens, now we're moving into the epicenter of intended transformation. And so there's actually layers of context. One is to actually put the actual facts in place that makes the story more robust. And then when you've got all your facts assembled, you've sort of created, I'm going to call it a corral, a fence, within which you can roam. And when you roam within this contextual fence, I'm going to call that interpolation. And when you get outside that fence, you get into the world of speculation. Mm-hmm. And I'm much more comfortable with interpolation. And, you know, there's some issues even with interpolation. But the interpolation that I like to try to do is to bring out issues that perhaps people can identify with or add to the list of things that they identify with so that they are more liable, more willing to place themselves into the very narrative itself and start to identify with one or more people in the passage. That's the umbrella. That's the task, I think, of a preacher, of a teacher, of an author. It's not just to retell the story, but to tell the story, retell the story in such a way that it draws people into it, mm-hmm. to the point where they start to identify with the people in it, and then the Holy Spirit can really do some powerful things. So, just to pause there for a moment. Does that make sense?
It does, and I really appreciate your differentiation between speculation and interpolation, because so much of what we get is speculation. And people pick and choose passages, verses, individual sentences, words, to make a point that may not be at all related to the original activity, the original action of the story. And I think what we all seek and what we miss in so many sermons is that interpolation of the context.
Yeah, it's so easy for a passage to become a trampoline just to jump off into mm-hmm. a whole pet theme or the issue of the day or something like that. But that's what context does. It actually builds a fence within which you can roam inside the fence, but you're not free to roam outside the fence. And
it helps you to realize that these were real people living in a real culture, having real thoughts and feelings and experiencing life in a certain way. And our task as to understand this is to try to get into their shoes so that we can see things the way they did, so we can extract the core message.
Absolutely. And that's why we kicked it off revisiting this passage in Luke 5 last week by asking a very basic question: how can a paralytic have friends? Now, on the surface, that doesn't seem like a big issue to us, but when we realize that the rabbis have taught that a whole class series of categories of people, including people with disabilities, are viewed as God doesn't like you, now suddenly it becomes amazing that they have any friends at all. And so now we get into where we know what the corral is. Now we can roam inside the corral and say, how does a person who the culture views as God doesn't like, how does that person ever get a friend? Mm-hmm. And that's what we dealt with the last time, or last week, is to try to understand how that might have taken place and then relate that to issues of people with disabilities today. Do we have friendships with people with disabilities today? Are our churches looking to establish friendships with the disability community? All those kinds of subjects come into view.
You know, we have, this reminds me of all those St. Jude's commercials I see of children working on our sympathy and our emotions and appealing to us as civilization here in the West for our money, for support for worthy causes. I'm not knocking the cause here. I'm just examining the technique here. They play upon our conscience to elicit support. That may not have been possible in first century Israel, because they would have seen birth defects and disabled people in a much different light. And we tend to sympathize, we tend to feel sorry for, even if we don't befriend them, even if we don't hang out with disabled people, we at least have either sympathy or empathy for them.
Yeah, and you know, I have a son who has disabilities, so this is more than just a personal passing interest here. Mm-hmm. But I sometimes, in the parallelism in which we're talking here, look at those commercials on TV and say, well, they want you to send money. But what they don't ask you to do is to come to the hospital and to get to meet the kids and establish a relationship with them. You know, that's what's going on in this passage. Mm-hmm. These potential friends didn't send a check to an institution. They decided somehow they became friends of the paralytic. And that's the key issue here. And so, you know, I often wonder, what was it about the paralytic that would cause at least one person initially to say, I want to have a relationship with you? I don't know the answer to that, but you have to conclude there must have been something special about this paralytic.
Could they have been Hellenistic Jews? Would that have made a difference? The friends?
In Capernaum, you'd be hard-pressed to find a Hellenistic Jew up in the northwest quadrant of the Sea of Galilee. That's the bastion of observant Judaism. Mm-hmm.
Is it also possible that that they were, they had some other maladies of some sort that similar to what he had, but not as crippling? I mean, they were strong enough to lower him through the roof.
Kind of a brotherhood of misery, huh?
But they had something else going on. They were tax collectors. They were a different skin color. They voted for Romney 2 years ago. I don't know. I mean, just other things that would cause them disfavor in the community.
It's hard to know how to respond to that. To take the tax collector example, would Levi have been amenable to this? I don't think so. He was so ostracized by his community, he wouldn't even want to almost journey into the center of Capernaum to try to find a paralytic. He led a very lonely, isolated life. So, you know, that's just part of the wonderment here. But once one person somehow established a friendship with this paralytic, he must have been instrumental in bringing others. And that's a whole other series of questions. How did he do that? What was his approach to other people to say, I want you to meet somebody who you probably don't want to meet, but can I strongly suggest you meet them nevertheless?
You know, I find it hard to believe that at heart level there wasn't compassion, even in that society. I can see the official dictums and the official stance of the religious establishment in Jerusalem and elsewhere. I can understand what rabbis taught, but people to people, people living with other people, some of whom are disabled or handicapped or diseased in some way, didn't they take care of each other on a home level or a village or in a clan?
I have a kind of a parallel to some of the things you're talking about, Doug, and it's a very disturbing situation for me personally. The 2 years ago, Carol and I went to Africa to get to know and to minister and to hang out with and to feed kids. We've got our church sponsors or is part of a group that sponsors an orphanage in Malawi, and one of the things that the director kept telling us, you know, during the time that we were there for 10 days. And he said, the most important thing you bring to us is the relationship, is the contact, is the continual support, and not the money, but just that these people know that somebody else gives a darn, that somebody else in the world cares for them, and that there is hope, and that they can also have hope through their Lord. And they but sense coming back, and to a certain extent, in the process of raising money to get over there, there has been a certain amount of pushback or a certain amount of reticence among I would say half the congregation of the particular church, that it's almost says, oh, okay, all right, we gave Dave and Carol a free trip to Africa, and then let's move on to some other stuff now. And they don't, but they don't want to talk about the relationship or the continuing relationship with these kids that now get to eat once a day or get a nutritional meal once a day. So there seems like there's some sort of a parallel in that the most of the congregation now would just as soon do something else.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges we have, and your observations are all apt ones, the challenge we have in this particular parable is to separate out our Western Hellenistic current cultural dynamic leanings from the reality of that culture in the first century. Jim, you were saying, I can't believe that people wouldn't be compassionate. They would, but only to people who are like themselves.
Right.
See, the rabbis have redefined who is your neighbor. They sort of changed it from the Levitical emphasis. The rabbis have said, my neighbor is someone who is just like me. Mm-hmm. That's why Jesus had to put forth the parable of the Good Samaritan. He had to redefine who a neighbor is. It's also people who are not like you. Mm-hmm. So one of the salient observations when you got two kinds of people, people who are like us and people who are not like us in this world of observant Judaism in the first century, is mercy is missing to people who are on the outside looking in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our natural instincts about kindness and compassion just don't work in that culture. Because if God doesn't like you, and I'm all about honoring God, and believe me, they're far more zealous about honoring God than we are, okay?
And yet, you know, that was a crossroads geographically, in Capernaum in particular. There must have been quite a mix of races and ethnicities, languages spoken there, constant traffic through it from one place to another. Didn't that affect the culture, or were the Hebrews so closed to that they insulated themselves from it?
Absolutely. It is a very insular community. You're either on the inside or you're on the outside. And those people who were coming down from Damascus on the International Highway, which skirted the edge of Capernaum here, which is going to go down the southern side of the western shore of the Sea of Galilee, eventually getting to the coast and eventually going down to Egypt, those people would have been viewed as Gentiles. Okay, mm-hmm. And you're forbidden to interact with Gentiles. So, yeah, even though there would have been proximity to a lot of people on the International Highway from this, it's estimated to be 7,500 people. Capernaum was the size of Capernaum in the first century. There is a lot of isolation and separation at the same time. So that's part of the backdrop that I find absolutely fascinating. There had to have been at least one person, and then ultimately two or three, or possibly a total of four here, who were willing to defy the norms of that culture to establish a relationship with a person that the rabbis and therefore their disciples held God doesn't like. That took courage. And that's another thing that jumps out at me here. And that's applicable even to our world today. A lot of people are really hesitant to enter the world of people with disabilities, to interact with Down syndrome people and that kind of thing. They're scared, they're hesitant, they're insecure, there's just an instinct to try to avoid those kind of things. And it does take courage to move into relationships with people in that community. And that's part of what I find absolutely fascinating here. And I think that's part of the challenge for each one of us individually, as well as corporately, or as well as for our small group. Are we reaching out to people with disabilities? Are we trying to intentionally even have friendships with people with disabilities, either corporately or individualistically? And so the dynamic that I am musing on, which I hope can be considered interpolative, you know, within mm-hmm. the corral of context here, really does have some implications for our world today as well.
Now, I'm reading in Luke here, the preceding story of Jesus healing the man with leprosy. And verse 15, it says, this is the NIV I'm reading from, yet the news about him spread all the more, so the crowds of people came to hear him and to be healed of their sicknesses. But Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. So the news had spread that he heals.
Well, it more than that. The very first encounter in Luke, and Luke's a Greek, and therefore he's into chronology, and that gives us actually special insight. Mm-hmm. The very first thing Jesus does is heal a leper, and a key part of that understanding, why would he do that? Well, actually, in the chapter before, in Nazareth, he cited God's mercy for a Syrian general who was leprous mm-hmm. and healed him. He reminded his Nazareth audience of that, which made them irate about God's mercy to Gentiles. And so he reprises it as his first act in Luke. He heals a leper. Part of the significance of that is wrapped up in the fact that the rabbis, a number of rabbis, have taught this, that healing a leper is so difficult, it's as difficult as bringing someone back from the dead. It will only happen when Messiah comes. Hmm. So that's why Jesus, in that encounter with the leper, immediately directs the leper not to talk to anyone. And that's been misunderstood as if Jesus is trying to keep this thing secret. No, he's trying to obey the Levitical law mm-hmm. that you have to go to the temple at Jerusalem. Inside the court of the women, there are four chambers. One of those chambers is the court of the lepers, where there's a mikvah, a ritual purification bath, and some priest who will inspect you to certify you that you are blemish-free. Because only until you're certified that way, you can't go back to your family, you can't go back to your small group, you can't hug anybody, even though you're healed. You mm-hmm. have to be certified to be blemish-free. And so this leper is Jesus' calling card to the establishment in Jerusalem, the Sanhedrin, mm-hmm. the Jerusalem Pharisees, the scribes, that the Messianic age is here. And this leper is Jesus' calling card. That's why in that very next verse you see, and suddenly he's on the radar screen, and suddenly people are coming from all over to check this guy out, okay? Mm-hmm. That's what's happening in the transition, if you will, between the healing of the leper and the forgiving and the healing of this paralytic. So we can deduce here that these four friends or three friends, I'm going to assume they're four because we're talking about a chaise lounge or a stretcher that gets carried.
In Mark it says four. So
it does.
Yeah.
Well, good. Luke doesn't give us that fact, mm-hmm. so I'm just trying to stay with Luke here.
Yeah.
It's reasonable to assume that they now know Yeshua, Jesus, is Messiah. And therefore, he just did a profound healing of the leper. Maybe he's up to another profound healing for their paralytic friend. But they got a problem. How are they going to find Jesus?
They need to get his attention.
How are they going to get in front of him?
Yeah. Well, he's surrounded by crowds, even outside the door, it says, so the people couldn't push their way in.
Well, it's a pretty good inference that Jesus has been making Simon Peter's mother-in-law's house his home away from home, mm-hmm. his basis for his ministry in Capernaum. So they at least know where he tends to hang out. They just don't know when's he going to show up. You know, it's not like some of these sole proprietor retail stores. Mm-hmm. You know, when they go out for lunch, they put the little clock in the window and say, be back at 1 o'clock.
No, do I know about that? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't think Jesus does that. I don't think he posts the daily event schedule by hour, you know. Mm. So they got to try to figure out. They know where he's probably going to be. They just don't know when it's going to happen. But before that, they have to caucus. That's an interesting phrase at this point in time, isn't it? To get the four of them to agree, let's bring them to Jesus. I wonder how easy that process was. Did they immediately say that was a great idea, or are they typically like a church where somebody will have an idea and most people are initially against it? Mm-hmm. And how did he win them over? How did he get everybody on the same page that we need to take them to Jesus?
Well, you know, if the natural process that you described earlier was followed, that is probably one person solidified a relationship with this paralytic and then brought others with him, that would have marked him as a leader.
Or the champion. And so he advances the idea. Most ideas are advanced by a champion, someone mm-hmm. who wants to take the cause on. And the issue now is how do you get the rest of the congregation, the rest of your small group, the rest of your community, your neighborhood, mm-hmm. To join you on this direction? And if it's like human nature that I've experienced, there's a whole range of responses to yeah, you know, that's an interesting idea. That'll never work. Mm-hmm. So there's some caucusing going on here, and eventually they all get on the same page. So now the issue is, we got to bring them to Jesus. All right, so put out the buzz. Let's listen and see. Let's get our networks activated here to see the next time Jesus shows up at Simon Peter's mother-in-law's house. Well, now that Jesus has healed the paralytic and is known as probably the Messiah, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are thinking that same thought.
Yeah, healed the leper, you mean, yeah.
So whenever Jesus does show up at Simon Peter's mother-in-law's house and the word starts to spread, all the people who are unencumbered show up quickly, but these guys have to carry a stretcher, a cot, a chaise lounge with it. Mm-hmm. So by naturally they're slowed down. They'll never get in line first. And when they get there, the courtyard is jammed. So can you imagine the response of some of the last converts to this idea? I knew this wasn't going to work.
Yeah. There's no way.
Okay.
Can you describe this house?
Let's turn around and go back home.
Can you describe the house, how it must have looked? What was typical then and there?
This was an insula home. It's a multi-room home. You can actually see it in Capernaum today. It's underneath the Roman Catholic Church, however, like a flying saucer kind of thing. Yeah. So it's awfully hard to discern. If you go up to Chorazin, which I often do, there's some great examples of insular room homes there where I can stand in a courtyard and actually teach this passage.
To an open air courtyard.
What we're talking about is a square that is probably 60 to 70 foot square.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a series of single rooms along the edges of the walls of this square. And with each successive generation, another room gets added for another son. So eventually, most of the square gets filled in. But there's always a courtyard that's kept open in the center that has an exit to the street.
Mm-hmm.
So what you want to do, think here, is you're walking into a 60-foot square stone edifice. And you walk through the door and you see rooms on three of the walls. Now, these rooms are going to be 15 foot deep, maybe, and 6 to 7 foot wide. And these rooms are going to be made out of black basalt. It's a volcanic rock. There were 19 active volcanoes at one time on the Golan Heights that put this black lava type material all throughout that northern Galilean district there. That's what you build your homes out of. There are no external windows to the outside, so you got a black room with no windows. It's pretty dark. And so Jesus, to my way of understanding here, would have been standing in one of the doorways of maybe 10 or 12 of these rooms, mm-hmm, fronting this square. And the crowds would have completely filled in the courtyard. And that's how he was teaching, standing in the doorframe, mm-hmm, of one of these rooms.
And how were those roofs constructed? I'm thinking of not basalt. It would have been something lighter and repairable.
Well,
grass,
basalt,
thatch?
It's not like granite. It doesn't, or limestone. It doesn't, hard limestone. It doesn't have the same structural strength. So you, mm-hmm, can make beams out of basalt, mm-hmm, but you don't want to have them more than 6 or 7 foot long. Mm-hmm. So that would be the first layer. There would be some beams along each one of these rooms to be the roof of that room.
Now imagine wood was scarce.
Relatively speaking, but you're going to find trees now, okay, and you're going to cut them down and the limbs and what have you, and you're going to start to make a lattice type pattern, and 90 degrees perpendicular to the way the basalt beams are laying, you're going to put now 4 and 5 inch branching, mm-hmm, okay, small, very trunks of very small trees. And then you're going to take like the 3-inch stuff and you're going to lattice it in the other direction, mm-hmm, and then you're going to start to put down mats made from palm trees, and eventually you get the idea here, you're building up a layer that has some stability on it, mm-hmm, and then you're going to start to put down clay and dirt and straw, and you're going to wet this material, and you're going to take like a huge rolling pin, like grandma used to do, you know, mm-hmm. when she would roll out the dough in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. I've actually had pictures of some of these things. They're like 3, 3.5 foot wide, and you'll start to work the wet clay and the dirt and the straw, you know, and work it in, and you'll put progressive layers of that down, and then you'll put grass up there because you don't want to be living in a all black room in the summertime in this culture. Mm. Boy, do those rooms heat up. Mm. So it's very common that you'll have your meals and maybe even sleep on the roof several months of the year. And that necessitates a back stairs to every one of these multi-room homes, these insula blocks of homes. And that's how the guys eventually got up there. But let's pause our story and leave them at the door to the courtyard here with the realization that plan A isn't going to work. And now what do the four think and feel from here?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, we'll pick that up next week. I want to mention, again, we're talking with Doug Greenwald, who is with Preserving Bible Times. It's a ministry that's been around for, 10 to 15 years now and based in Columbia, Maryland. And the expertise that they bring is teaching the historic and cultural context of Scripture. And I've never seen a source in my years as a Christ follower that provides as many aha moments as does Preserving Bible Times. Beautiful website, preservingbibletimes.org. You can link to them from our site at Broken Road Radio, and I recommend that you do that. You'll find just a wealth of resources, DVDs, articles, books by Doug and by others. Just a great place to go and visit, and you'll find things for your church library, for your small groups and Bible studies. It's just an excellent place to go, and we recommend it highly.
And just to let you know, as soon as we get off the line here, and within 30 minutes, I'm going to send out the first February reflection, and it's going to be on the front end here of this paralytic's amazing friend. So if some of your listeners are not in the Preserving Bible Times database, well, sign up or let us know, and we'll forward that reflection to you.
It's free. It comes to you monthly. You'll look forward to Doug's reflections. I guarantee that. And we'll look forward to getting that one later today. Doug, have a great week. We'll see you.
Thanks, guys.
So long. See you, Doug. Thank you.